You're listening to Greater LA, KCRW's show that connects you to the people and the places of Southern California. I'm Steve Chiotakis.
You ready,
There are few things more rock and roll than these opening chords. Yeah, that's Tom Petty's classic, American Girl. Cody Marks is jamming with her LA-based band.
When they hear that bow, 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 the place goes crazy. Even the COs, you can hear their keys jingling.
It's 1 o'clock on a Saturday afternoon, and the venue is a packed gymnasium at San Diego's Richard J. Donovan Correctional Facility. It is a state prison a few miles from the Mexican border. You can see Tijuana from the yard.
Oh, yeah. All right.
Thank you so much for coming. I know that a lot of you, or some of you, might think it's weird that we play prisons, but I'm the biggest Johnny Cash fan that ever lived. And I believe that I was put here to continue his journey, and I believe he would be real proud of all of us here, right?
Johnny Cash, of course, famously did live concerts at California prisons, such as Folsom and San Quentin, back in the 1960s. He even testified at a Senate hearing on prison reform. As part of an international nonprofit called Jail Guitar Doors, the Cody Marks Band has picked up on Cash's mission. The group provides music classes and interaction with professional musicians like Marks. She's on a tour of California's 35 prisons, and she's here to inspire and help rehabilitate those inmates.
I like to bring a little bit of freedom, a little bit of dignity. Once we're in there and we're playing, it's the most amazing feeling in the world, and it goes by so fast.
Reporter Jesse Hardman went to Cody Marks' gig at Donovan Prison and has this story.
So thanks for coming.
Cody Marks is decked out in a black jumpsuit with her name on the lapel as she steps to the microphone.
We played a lot of California correctional facilities. I've never been here. It's beautiful. I mean, for a prison, right? Let's call it what it is.
Originally from Florida, Marks moved out to Los Angeles years ago, hoping to become a rock star. She wound up playing clubs like the Coconut Teaser on the Sunset Strip, but never quite saw her career take off in the way that she'd hoped. In 2008, things clicked. She played her first prison and found her audience.
And like, I'm legendary now. I mean, like, sometimes I'll walk on a yard and you hear, Cody, Cody, hundreds of guys. And I'm like, hello. And again, it's not like I wanted to do this for any kind of fame or notoriety or whatever, but it is cool to be acknowledged.
Marks's fans today are wearing prison-issued baby blue shirts with CDCR in yellow stenciled on the back. California Department of Corrections and Rehabilitation. 54-year-old inmate Terry Benjamin Lewis enthusiastically stomps his feet to the music.
I had Cody autographed her flyer here, you know, and she approached us really nice. She wasn't like afraid of us or standoffish,
exactly.
So it's really awesome, dude.
Lewis says after 28 years of incarceration, access to everything from concerts to computer classes helped drive his quest for parole.
Well, it inspires everybody and to keep you in touch with your human side. You know, when you get treated like a human being, you respond like a human being.
RJ Donovan Prison is comprised of 6 yards with varying levels of security. Today's concert is happening at Echo, a medium security facility. That means less guards and more access to rehabilitative activities. Inmates are doing everything from playing chess to training dogs in the big open yard.
The best part about this yard is the ocean breeze. It's a constant breeze that cools us down.
49-year-old inmate Robert Hosselton's been incarcerated for murder a decade so far.
This is the Southern California dream right here. I've been in prisons all over the state, and I love it here.
Hosselton recently got transferred to RJ Donovan and got involved in Jail Guitar Doors' weekly music workshop.
We sat in a practice room, and we each spit out a few lyrics. So we all sat down, and we all contributed, and then one guy took them all and made a song out of it.
A few original songs came out of the class, and even a band. Today's concert features Cody Marks, but the prison band Hosselton plays bass in is performing too.
We call ourselves the Prophets of Peace. This music program has been tremendous for all of us.
Thank you so much.
San Diego resident Rob Bird runs the Jail Guitar Doors workshops at RJ Donovan. He's there for 12 hours every Wednesday, helping inmates learn instruments and write songs. He says the Prophets of Peace are a good example of what's possible with rehabilitative programs. The group features Black, Latino, and white members, people that often end up self-segregating in prisons.
I see people who would walk in just as happily wanting to kill each other, leaving, hugging each other.
California officials have tried to measure the impact of rehab programs like this one on inmate recidivism. California State Assemblyman Reggie Jones Sawyer represents the 59th District, which includes parts of South L.A. He's looking to get some new ideas on how to better serve his district, one that includes a lot of formerly incarcerated people.
Over 100,000 people are incarcerated in our prison system right now. Most of them will come home. We have to make sure that they are rehabilitated so they we can reintegrate them back into society. Otherwise, they're going to commit crimes again and become a problem to society.
Joan Sawyer ordered an audit of state prisons' rehabilitation programs. The results came out earlier this year and said recidivism is still high, around 50%. Jail Guitar Doors' Robert Bird says he knows the state of California needs to see that percentage drop, but he says an increasing amount of anecdotal evidence from programs like his exists.
We've had an inmate confide in us that he put down meth and reawakened his relationship with his 24-year-old adult daughter because of his interaction with other inmates in our program. Now he's writing his own songs.
C to F.
For Cody Marks' grand finale, around a dozen inmates jump in on the Rolling Stones classic, You Can't Always Get What You Want.
And when you try sometimes D to F.
The band's lead guitarist, Jeff Scott, gets eight prisoners up to speed on guitar. Other inmates play drums, provide backup vocals, and even a little harmonica. Cody Mark says it's fun to interact with the inmates and jam with them, but she tries to remember that some of them did unspeakable things, like one inmate drummer she befriended who murdered a woman.
It kind of broke my heart. It broke my heart for his family. It broke my heart, obviously, for the victim's family and for him, because he's like a great drummer. He's fun to be around. But at the end of the day, he's a murderer. So I deal with a lot of different emotions about that.
After her set, Marks chats up 52-year-old inmate Robert Watson. He's been participating in the Jail Guitar Doors workshop, but was too nervous to perform his original song today.
By the chorus is, I can't hide all this damage inside. Digging deep, I'm trying to find something, anything to help me feel alive. That's my chorus.
Watson says he struggled to express himself his entire life. He says learning how to write songs has given him some confidence to do that.
All the damage and problems I've caused in my life and in people's lives.
Why are you in here?
For murder. I'm a broken person. This place helped me write a song.
Music has given Watson something he didn't have before, a positive habit.
You never felt this way.
Up on stage, an inmate wraps up the concert with one of the most vulnerable songs out there, Chris Isaak's Wicked Game.
Nobody loved me like you.
Cody Marks and her bandmates pick up their gear, say their goodbyes to the audience, and head back on the road towards L.A. Mark says it was one of her best concerts yet.
I think it's going to be a pretty quiet prison tonight. I think there was a lot of humbleness and a lot of love. So I think we did our job today.
Johnny Cash, no doubt, would have been proud. For KCRW, I'm Jesse Hardman.
I hear the train a-coming, it's rolling around a bend. And I ain't seen the sunshine since I don't know when. I'm stuck in Folsom Prison.
Oh, and time keeps Man in Black. Coming up on Greater L.A., you use it on your lunch, perhaps. Could salt be at the center of L.A.'s energy storage future? You're listening to Greater LA on KCRW.
When I was just a baby, my mama told me, son, always be a good boy, don't ever play with guns.
Introducing the KCRW donation car, designed to be recycled. This first-of-its-kind vehicle will save you time, space, and hassle by disappearing. Enjoy the luxury and comfort of turning your underused car into a donation worth hundreds, even thousands of dollars. The KCRW donation car, already in your garage, driveway, or on cinder blocks outside your house. Act now at kcrw.com/cars.
You're listening to Greater LA on KCRW. I'm Steve Chiatakis. This may come as a surprise to you, but there's a coal plant in Utah that's been LA's single largest source of power for three decades. It's called the Intermountain Power Plant, and it supplies the city of LA with about a fifth of its electricity. But that plant is scheduled to shut down in a few years, in 2025, as California commits to going 100% renewable. So the question is, what will replace it? Well, the answer may include wind or solar, or maybe even salt. Sammy Roth covers energy for the LA Times, and he joins me right now. Hi, Sammy.
Hey, Steve.
This coal power plant near Delta, Utah, I believe. You went for a visit, didn't you?
I did.
And it's got an interesting next-door neighbor. Tell us what you found out.
So it's a really interesting site up there. It's about 100 miles south of Salt Lake City. I was there in the winter when everything was covered in snow. And sort of by total coincidence, they built this coal plant quite literally across the street from this underground salt dome that is one of the best salt domes in the western United States.
All right, so explain to me, Sammy, what exactly is a salt dome? I suspect this isn't where you go to get your seasonings, right?
It's not, although I guess technically you could if you could drill down there and pull some of the salt out. I mean, honestly, it's exactly what it sounds like. It's a big mound of salt. It's under the ground. It's about a mile from top to bottom, a couple of miles wide. And there are companies that want to basically mine these caverns. They want to carve out these hollow caverns in the salt, and they want to basically pump air into it using extra wind and solar power, power that otherwise wouldn't get used. And then when we need that renewable power that we've basically stored in this underground salt dome, we would let the air out, it would turn a turbine, it would generate electricity.
How does it get stored? I mean, what is it about the salt that stores it?
So the thing about the salt that's cool is that it's this perfect underground formation where you can, you know, it's solid, you can put stuff in it, you can carve out these caverns with water, just dissolve the salt, you know, create these underground caverns. And it creates this really secure space underground, basically. So the idea is that when you've got extra solar and wind, you take that, you use it to basically compress air really, really tight into these underground caverns that you've built. You pack these salt caverns full of this air using the extra solar and wind power you've got. And then when you don't have enough solar and wind, when you need energy on the grid, you let the air out of these caverns. It sort of comes rushing out because it's been packed in so tight. It turns a turbine, it generates electricity for you.
So this is convenient because it's next to a coal-fired power plant, right? Right next door.
Well, yeah, and what's convenient about it is that we've got this power line that goes 500 miles from L.A. out to this site in Utah that delivers the coal power. The coal plant's going to shut down in 2025, as you said, and then we're going to have this big power line with all this space on it. So the idea is you build some solar and wind up in this region, and then you've got this salt dome that you can basically use like a really big battery to store the stuff for when we need it.
If it's used, Sammy, to its full potential, how much energy are we talking about? How much can this salt dome store?
Good question. Hard to say because there are still proposals being developed, but a lot. I mean, hundreds, maybe even thousands of megawatts could be stored in there. It's a, you know, potentially really significant quantity.
Is this being done anywhere else?
Yeah, so it's a technology that's been around for a while, not to store solar and wind so much, but the idea of it's basically been used for like arbitrage in other places. So you store energy when prices are cheap and you're not going to be able to make a lot by selling it, and then you generate energy from these salt domes when prices are high and you can make money. But interestingly, it's only been done in two other places. I mean, those have been around for decades, but it's only been done twice. So it's kind of a weird combination of proven but unusual.
You mentioned that these salt domes were discovered. Were they being used for something, or are they just natural and hey, there's a salt dome down there?
Yeah, it's a weird coincidence, but just kind of natural. It was they were discovered this dome was discovered in the 70s by drillers who were looking for oil and gas, which you know there's a lot of in Utah, obviously, but not in this particular spot. They found basalt; it wasn't useful to them. They kind of just moved on, and you know that was 40 years ago. And lo and behold, now it looks like there's a use for it.
Are there downsides to storing energy in salt deposits? Is there any chemical reaction that can happen, or is it dangerous in any way? Like, is there a danger of it coming out too quickly with all that power, as you mentioned?
The one significant downside that I know of is the fact that even though it's this technology that's supposed to help you use more solar and wind and go more renewable, there is actually a component to the compressed air of burning natural gas, which is a fossil fuel. Less natural gas use than like at a power plant, but still it's a fossil fuel and contributes to climate change. So it's, you know, the folks at Los Angeles Department of Water and Power, they said they've got some heartburn over that, was the way they put it.
Some heartburn. You mentioned, obviously, LADWP trying to go 100% renewable. Despite this discovery, there's talk of building a gas-fired power plant at Intermountain. Why not choose clean energy all the way if that's where the state of California and the city of LA, if that's where they want to head? Why not just do it?
Well, so it depends. It depends on who you ask. I've talked to DWP about this pretty extensively, and they've made a couple of different arguments. One of the arguments they've made, which is kind of interesting, is this power line that they've got running from Utah to Southern California. You know, they say that for very complicated technical engineering reasons, they won't actually be capable of bringing over solar and wind power on that line unless they have this firm gas plant that can generate all the time at the other end of the line. I've talked to a bunch of experts about that who disputed that and said that, you know, they really don't have to go ahead with it. There's also a political question. I mean, they built this thing in Utah. LA doesn't actually own it. We kind of control it, but it's owned by these cities in Utah, and they want the gas plant to get built. LA has this relationship with them going back 30 years that sort of, you know, makes it politically complicated where they want the gas plant, and it becomes a question of how much hardball are we going to play with these folks that who have partnered with us for a long time. But yes, to get at your question, I mean, there's definitely a pretty compelling argument that, you know, clean energy advocates and you know, climate change advocates have made to say, well, we're going all the way to 100% clean energy. Why aren't we investing our resources in figuring out creative ways to not have to build this?
And it sounds like those salt domes are going to play a key role in that in the future, right?
I think that Los Angeles Department of Water and Power has really big plans for the salt dome. If things work out as they want, it's going to be a really significant resource for Los Angeles.
And we always thought that salt was a preservative. I guess in this case, it really is.
It's weird. It's, you know, getting to 100% clean energy is the kind of thing that it's almost certainly going to take a lot of creative and outside of the box thinking to get all the way there. And, you know, if this underground salt can do it, like, I want to see them try. Like, this will be fun to look at as a reporter.
Well, I'll be watching, certainly. Sammy Roth, who covers energy for the LA Times. Sammy, thank you.
You're welcome, Steve.
Well, coming up next on KCRW, what if those dreaded words, last call, came later? Turns out there's another bill in the works. It's Greater LA, right here on KCRW. Listening to Greater LA on KCRW. I'm Steve Chiotakis. At the late night lounge, after a night of friendly imbibing, those house lights going brighter can bring immense sadness to one's heart. They even made a song about it.
Closing time, one last call for alcohol, so finish your whiskey or beer.
A bill making its way through the California legislature is trying to extend those bar hours until 4 a.m. in L.A. and other cities. There was a similar proposal by State Senator Scott Wiener last year, but former Governor Jerry Brown used his executive authority to shut it down, saying it would add, quote, two more hours of mischief and mayhem for police. Well, now Wiener's bill has reemerged, for the most part, in a pilot program that would let a handful of communities experiment with a new nightlife time slot. It's already passed the Senate, And recently, KCRW's David Weinberg hit up a local watering hole at closing time to find out what L.A. folks think of the plan to let them keep on drinking.
Would you drink till 4 if you could?
Hell yeah.
Would I drink till 4 if I could? Yes.
I mean, I think in New York it's like that, right? And I would think, like, it's weird that kind of, yeah, we're not allowed to do that.
I think it'd be smart for the government because they would make money if they stayed open 2 hours later. But also, I don't think that they need to loosen up. I think they need to make sure that people are not driving drunk.
I like closing down a bar. Closing down a bar is fun. But if it happens at 4, then it, like, wrecks the next day. So I feel like what I want to do is close it down at 2 a.m., feel like a badass, and then go party at home, you know, until 4.
Oh, the debaucherous life of people at the bar at closing time, including our Mona Holmes, who's with us, editor at Eater LA, one of our regulars here at Greater LA. Hi, Mona.
Hi, Steve.
Is that you? Were you one of those people who's like, you know, it's closing time, I want to hang out for a couple more hours?
Potentially. Yeah. I mean, my late night bar days are kind of not...
Yours and mine both.
Yeah, yeah. I tend to stay at home occasionally.
But... What does this bill propose?
So if it's passed and signed by Governor Newsom, SB 58 would require that the Department of Alcoholic Beverage Control would start a pilot program where 10 California cities would get to extend last call between 2 and 4 a.m. So that's Los Angeles, West Hollywood, Long Beach, Palm Springs, Cathedral City, Coachella, Sacramento, Fresno, Oakland, and San Francisco. So if it's approved, it'll start in 2022. And the bill provides autonomy to these cities where they can figure out exactly what they want to do. It also requires that cities create a study towards the end of the pilot period where they assess all the data from local governments and law enforcement and other bodies that'll look at data from crime statistics to police reports, medical emergency services, so they can figure out what kind of impact this would have on these communities.
As I mentioned, the former governor, Jerry Brown, vetoed a similar bill last year. What are some of the big concerns, Mona, that have kept that law from making it past the finish line before? I mean, well, people are reluctant to do this because they're afraid, as then Governor Brown said, of more debauchery after 2 a.m.
Well, I mean, he sided with law enforcement, who basically said that he cited safety concerns. And there's a councilman, Paul Koretz, who agrees with them. He believes that there would be an increase in alcohol-related injuries, crime, death, litter. But about those concerns about drunk driving, I also spoke to Mark Smith, the owner of Three Clubs on Vine Street. And he has a 60-car parking lot that he's had for decades because he's had this bar for almost 30 years. And he pretty much says that it sits empty every single night because no one drives to the bar anymore. Everyone ride shares.
How important, Mona, do you think it is for LA to nurture a vibrant nightlife economy? I mean, it could be just a sleepy city, and that's what we are.
It's crucial, Steve. I'm sure that you have heard from every out-of-towner that has come into Los Angeles and said, why does it shut down so early? So this bill has the potential to put Los Angeles and all these other cities on par with cities like New York and Tokyo, where they've got this really vibrant bar scene that goes forever. And so, but also too, it's not just bars. People are usually hungry after a night of drinking, and so there's a potential impact on restaurants and street vendors where they'll see more income as well.
We're talking 2 hours between 2 a.m. and 4 a.m. Is that a lot of money that those bars and those restaurants can make?
A ton. And I like to point to the city of Miami as an example. There's been a call lately from local residents that want to pull back last call from whenever hour to 2 a.m. But a studies commission revealed that these clubs and bars, restaurants, hotels will lose up to $16 million in revenue every year. And the city itself will lose tax revenue in the amount of $11 million annually.
Gavin Newsom is, I dare say, a lot younger than Jerry Brown. I don't know if it's a generational thing or what, but what do we know about this quote-unquote new governor and what he will do about this bill?
We don't, actually. I mean, he's remaining pretty tight-lipped about it. But Governor Newsom has business interests in hospitality that includes 4 hotels, 4 Napa Valley wineries, bars, restaurants, a wine store, a liquor store. I'm not implying that he's already in favor of SB 58.
Or he could be against it because he doesn't want to give that impression.
It's very possible. I'm sure that he'll tell us when this finally comes up to a vote. But I think it's crucial that we acknowledge his business interests that would be directly impacted by Senate Bill 58.
All right, duly noted. Mona Holmes from Eater LA on Greater LA. Mona, as always, thanks.
Thanks, Steve.
That's the show for today. Tomorrow, the biggest oil spill in California that you probably don't know about. It's DNA, next on KCRW. Online, of course, we are at kcrw.com/greaterLA. I'm Steve Chiatakis, honored by your presence. Thanks for your ear. Have a great day.